I think I'm going to sleep for like a week and then think about something else when I wake up.
Organizers trying to repeal oil tax reform finish their successful signature drive. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Tenneke Springs struggles to keep its school open.
We cannot just put our child on a bus and send them to another school in another district that's close by, especially in Tenneke, because we are so remote.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Admissions representatives from Brown University, MIT, and from Yale University are hosting college information sessions to discuss academic programs, campus life, selective college admissions, and financial aid. On Saturday, July 13th, the session will be in Anchorage in the Assembly Chambers at Lusac Library. And on Sunday, July 14th, the session will be in Juneau at the downtown branch of the Juneau Public Library. Register online at admissions.yale.edu. This message sponsored by Yale University.
Tomorrow is the deadline for a group trying to repeal a tax cut on oil companies. Yes, Repeal the Giveaway needs at least 30,000 verified signatures to get a referendum on the August primary ballot. So far, more than 45,000 people have signed the petition booklets.
It's exceeded my expectations.
That's Pat Lavin. He's helping organize the referendum effort and says they're still collecting signatures in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and a few other communities. The group's goal is to turn over a law that's projected to lower taxes on oil companies by at least $3 billion over the next 5 years. The tax cut has long been a priority of Governor Sean Parnell as a way of spurring oil production in the state. But critics say there's no guarantee that will happen. Lavin says having so many signatures should give the group a good buffer in case some are disqualified. Gail Fanumiai directs the State Division of Elections, and she says usually a few thousand ballot proposition signatures are thrown out.
When you look at this, you'll probably find an average, you know, maybe around 10% of the total signatures submitted don't qualify.
Even though the referendum group has exceeded their goal by more than 50%, they probably won't beat the known record for most signatures collected. In 2005, an initiative that would have banned aerial wolf hunting got more than 55,000 signatures and ultimately got voted down. But Lavin notes that initiatives have a whole year to collect signatures, while referenda only get 3 months. And he says those months have certainly been exhausting.
I think I'm going to sleep for like a week and then think about something else when I wake up.
Lavin adds that so far the group hasn't settled on a strategy for how they're going to campaign once they get all of their signatures in. That's scheduled to happen at 3 p.m. tomorrow at the Division of Elections Ship Creek Avenue office in Anchorage. The Federal Aviation Administration is increasing the amount of hours required to become a co-pilot for a commercial air carrier. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the change goes into effect August 1st.
Co-pilots, technically known as first officers, will now be required to hold an air transport license. It will take 1,500 hours to qualify for that. And that's quite the increase, up from today's standard 250 hours.
That doesn't mean that your first officer only had 250 hours.
Matthew Macri is the director of operations for Pennair. He says most officers have well exceeded the 250-hour mark, and the change won't be too onerous.
We've known this has been coming long enough that for the past 2 years, most carriers have been able to adapt their hiring practices so that it wouldn't be a catastrophic event to where they have to, you know, furlough half of their crew force until they have enough flight time.
Congress mandated the FAA change the requirements after a regional carrier in the Northeast crashed and killed 50 people. The FAA blamed a lack of pilot training in that crash. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The school in Tenneke Springs has less than a month to double the size of its student body or risk closing. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Tenneke Springs is nestled into the side of a fjord on Chichagof Island, about 50 miles north of Sitka. You can only get there by plane or boat. It has a general store, a bathhouse, some lodges, a harbor, a seaplane base, and, depending on the time of year, between 50 and 150 residents. Of those residents, five are enrolled in the local public school for next year. That's right, five. Here's the problem.
We need 10 students in order to be considered a school under state law.
Shauna Harper lives in Tenneke. Her 16-year-old son is entering his senior year at the K-12 school. Harper is also on the regional school board that will make the decision whether to keep the school open. In many ways, the stakes of keeping a school open are higher here than in other, less remote parts of the country.
We cannot just put our child on a bus and send them to another school in another district that's close by, especially in Tenekee, because we are so remote that the students have no other alternative rather than to move out of the community or homeschool or take some type of correspondence school.
When a school in Alaska dips below 10 students, it starts losing state funding, sometimes all at once, sometimes over a period of 3 years. It's up to individual districts to make the decision whether to close. The Chatham School District, to which Tenekee belongs, has been in this position before. Harper says twice in the last 20 years, Tenekee's student population has been low enough to consider closing. Both times, the board voted to keep the school open and draw money from its reserves.
But in those other two instances, we had like 9 students. This year, we're looking at 5.
It's a wider gap that might be harder to bridge. And if the school closes,
we would look at going to Gus Davis. Because it is in the district.
The potential exodus of families from Tenekee is just one of the factors that worries residents like Darius Menino.
My wife and I first came to Tenekee in 1996. We were here for maybe 3 years. Then we went to, then we were back and forth between here and Juneau.
They came back to Tenekee about 2.5 years ago.
Oh, well, we had a daughter. And so we thought, we wanted to raise her here.
Her name is Isla, and she's 3. Menino says he and his wife want Isla to grow up in a community with generational diversity, a mix of old and young residents.
Each of those groups interact with each other, and I think that, to me, makes a rich community, that those interactions, that's one of the unique parts of Tenekee, is that, you know, the kids have always had to learn to talk to the adults and talk to the older members of the community and vice versa. And so
one worry is the social and cultural impact the school's closure might have. Another concern, the economy.
They are the largest employer in town right now.
The school employs 7 people. It's also the largest consumer of utilities in Tenekee Springs. And Gordon Chu, who chairs the smaller advisory school board in Tenekee, says they've tried a lot of things in the past to keep the school population up. They've reached out to families and surrounding communities. They've advertised in magazines and newspapers. The school even tried to attract foreign exchange students, but that didn't pan out.
The program we were working with found out very late in our enrollment period that we didn't have a hospital, and their program did not allow their foreign exchange students to be so far away from a primary medical facility.
So now they're trying to spread the news that the school enrollment is low in hopes that someone will move their family to Tenekee Springs and boost the numbers. But in a matter of weeks? Well, Chu says that's not as far-fetched as it sounds.
It has happened numerous times before, and some of our greatest assets right now are people that moved here and stayed. We had a family of 5 move out a couple of years ago from Juneau, and they stayed as long as they could, but they had to move on. And we just don't seem to have any aces in the hole this year.
Chu says the situation is dire. But like any Hail Mary pass, you just hope the ball lands in the right place.
Like selling anything, you just have to get the word to the right person, and you never know how that's going to happen.
They have until the end of July. Then the superintendent of the Chatham School District makes a recommendation on whether to close the school. The board is expected to make its decision around August 6th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a cyclist describes a terrifying encounter on the Alaska Highway.
It was kind of wild. I wasn't expecting it, so my first thought was, wow, that's a huge dog. And right after I had that thought, though, he lunged forward and snapped up at my foot.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
A new oncology unit at Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna had its grand opening this week. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, it's the latest development in a broader effort to expand medical services on the peninsula.
With some assistance from a few cancer survivors, Kenai Mayor Pat Porter summed up why this latest addition to CPH is so important with four letters.
To leave our homes for radiation treatment again.
Porter has been leaving home a lot herself recently, undergoing regular radiation treatments in Anchorage. The sign held up to the crowd Wednesday afternoon came from her own living room and served as a reminder for just how important that place is.
You must make choices for extended stay with relatives or friends, rent hotel rooms, fly back and forth on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, take leave from employment, and the list goes on.
The Oncology Center is just one part of a bigger effort to provide more and more specialized services at the borough-owned hospital. This spring, the Borough Assembly approved spending $3 million for design on a new office building that will provide yet more services. The hospital's CEO, Rick Davis, says that as the age of Peninsula residents grows steadily older, the need for those services will grow right along with it.
The fact that our older segment is the fastest growing, you know, points to the fact that we're going to need more cancer services, more orthopedic, you know, more joint replacements. Cardiology needs are going to grow. So, you know, for the next 10 to 15 years, those are going to be very fast growing needs. You know, what happens in 20 years, I'll be there needing it by that time.
After a few short speeches by other hospital officials and dignitaries, the ribbon was cut and the crowd was ushered in for a look by the center's clinical director, John Halligan.
This is our welcome room, and we try to start the healing before the healing begins.
The place looks typically clinical, but with little touches here and there, which have been designed specifically to provide a warm, welcoming environment for patients.
Now inside, you'll go around the corner. This is called the vault, and it is a lot of concrete. If you haven't seen the walls, they're about 4 feet thick, some places as thick as 8 feet. So it's really protecting the outside from the radiation on the inside.
The price tag for the new center was about $10 million. A team of three physicians will serve around 200 patients per year. Reporting from Soldotna, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
A cyclist had the race of his life recently in Yukon as he pedaled to outrun a wolf chasing him along the Alaska Highway. Three cyclists are biking from Idaho to Alaska's North Slope to raise money for charity. About 60 miles west of Watson Lake, Mac Holland's two companions stopped to fix some bike equipment, leaving him to ride ahead. When he heard breathing behind him, he thought his teammates had caught up. He looked back to see a wolf instead. Here's Holland in his own words telling the story to CBC Radio in Whitehorse.
We were riding with two buddies up to Prudhoe, and the two of them had stopped to tighten up something on one of their racks, and we were, I guess, about 60 miles west of Watson Lake, and about 5 minutes after they dropped back, I heard a sound behind me kind of breathing, and I thought one of them had caught up, and I turned over and looked to my right. And there was a wolf just running along right beside my bike, right behind my bike. And it was kind of wild. I wasn't expecting it, so my first thought was, wow, that's a huge dog. And right after I had that thought, though, he lunged forward and snapped up at my foot. And so I switched my bike up into high gear and kind of got the adrenaline shot. And I reached up. I've got bear spray in my handlebar bag. And I sprayed him in the face. And he backed up about 20 feet. And I thought he was going to stop. And I thought, oh, what a wild story, you know, I'm glad that's over. And then he kept running again and came back up to the back of my bike and actually attacked the back of my bike and ended up ripping the bag that I carry my tent stakes and poles in, ripped it off the back of my bike and spilled it all over the highway. And so at that point I turned around and sprayed him again, and he backed up about 20 feet. And I just kept pedaling and pedaling and pedaling and was thinking, wow, this is, you know, he's not going away. And so every time he would come up, he a couple times just kept coming up towards my bike to attack it again. I just kept putting a quick spray, a bear spray, you know, in the air behind me, and that would slow him down. And then I heard a car coming around the corner, and I was really relieved. I thought, okay, great. If I can just keep him far enough back and go fast enough, they'll stop and I'll jump in and it's over. And this 18-wheeler came around the corner, and he slowed down. I thought, okay, great, the wolf's, you know, 20, 30 feet back. I can probably do this. And he slowed down, looked at me, looked at the wolf, and then just sped back up and drove off. And that actually ended up happening with four separate cars. Some folks pointed, one car stopped and took pictures, and they could just kept going, though. All I was thinking is, oh, I've seen all these shows, and wolves just run their prey till they get tired, and then they, you know, then they get them. And I came around this corner, and there was a hill, and I just thought, oh, you know, this is it. And so I just started, you know, racing through my head, what am I going to do, what am I going to do? And I guess the only thought I had was that I can just get off my bike and kind of squat behind it, and I've got, you know, half a can of bear spray left, and that'll have to do it. And right at that moment, another RV came around the corner, and then I just got myself in the center of the road, and then he actually sped up and then just went right in front of me and kind of parked at a 45 right in front of me, just slammed on the brakes. It was kind of funny. I ran to the back door of the RV and it was locked. And I was actually in the process of trying to jump up through one of their windows, just screaming. And, you know, I'm sure it's sounding great. And the guy threw open the passenger side door and I jumped in there. I shut the door and I looked in the rearview mirror. And right when the door shut, the wolf jumped on my bike and started attacking my tent bag again. And at that point, a bunch of other cars pulled up and were honking at it, and it was just sitting over my bike. Like, I think, you know, I thought maybe it was a killer. I don't know what it thought it was, but it was just sitting there, and people were honking and yelling, and finally someone got out and threw a metal water bottle and hit it in the head, and it ran off.
That's Mac Holland, a cyclist, telling his story to CBC Radio in Whitehorse about how he pedaled to outrun a wolf that chased him along the Alaska Highway near Watson Lake. A new project in Anchorage helps kids combine playing outside with reading books. Best Beginnings project manager Barbara Brown hosted the Story Tracks ribbon-cutting event on the Lusac Public Library lawn yesterday. Each page of the children's book, We're Going on a Bear Hunt, was laminated and mounted on signposts so that kids could read together and run around at the same time. Brown says thanks to an Anchorage Parks Foundation grant, they'll be able to create 10 sets of laminated books that will soon make the rounds to parks and trails across the city.
Okay, let's sing along.
We're going on a bear hunt. We're going.
I like to call it, it's like picture books and parade. The idea is it's bringing together reading with movement, with being outdoors, which is just what we were really trying to do. They're going to be available for people to check out and organizations to check out. And that way, every event can become family friendly.
To see photos of the first Story Tracks and to hear a four-year-old's take on the event, visit alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Aaron Selbig. This week on AK, game entrepreneurs. Hundreds of years in the future, Earth is rendered uninhabitable. Brothers Raymond and Rusty Hayes are battling for survival. Their weapons? A board, a deck of cards, and some dice. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver takes us inside the world of War Command, a board game the brothers are designing in Wrangell.
Are you using all these ones?
No.
Raymond Hayes sits at his kitchen table. He's dealing out a deck of cards with intricate pictures of aliens, warships, and magical creatures.
Okay, so we're gonna roll to see who goes first.
I win.
I got a one.
Five. Then we each draw five cards.
His brother Rusty stares intently into his hand.
So now Rusty has three actions on his turn. An action is moving with a character, attacking with a character, or playing a spell or upgrade card out of your hand.
Rusty puts his first card down on the board, which looks like the surface of a desolate planet.
It is a game of war.
These two brothers grew up in Wrangell, and as kids, they played a lot of board games. And now, they've decided to create their own. Their game is called War Command. While sitting in a coffee shop a little over a year ago, Raymond said the storyline just popped into his head.
Our game mixes fantasy-style characters with sci-fi-style characters, which is much more challenging than I anticipated when we did that at first.
In the game, there are futuristic humans and two other species fighting for control of a planet. They've all ended up there because of a catastrophic event.
Basically, there's a radiation blast that takes place in the universe, and it's traveling throughout the universe, pretty much disintegrating everything in its path.
During the battles, some characters use magic, others use technology, and some just get lucky. The Hayes brothers had to rely on a little bit of each during their design process. Rusty says he always liked Raymond's idea for the game, but never really thought it would get off the ground.
I've been programming games since I was like in ninth grade or so, and I think when Raymond first came to me with this game idea, all I said was like, that's a really great idea, Raymond, but that's just too big. You'll never get that done. And then he came to me with the team kind of more put together in a more serious game design document. I was like, oh my God, well, we have to move on this now.
Being from a small town in Alaska means the brothers don't really have local access to a lot of graphic designers and artists. So they hit up the internet and websites like DeviantArt that feature independent art portfolios to put together a team. Working with the brothers are a PR person and graphic designer, an art director, and 17 artists from around the world.
We've got illustrator who works on our team from Malaysia, one from Australia.
Portugal, right?
Yeah, Portugal, Norway. It's kind of neat.
Most of the team is working for free until the game makes some money, but they think it's got a good chance of succeeding. The team took War Command to the Salt Lake City, Utah-based gamers convention called SaltCon. They presented it as a mobile app, but they brought along some demo tabletop board games so other gamers could test it out in person. And the brothers were amazed by the response.
It was relieving after you put so much time into something and get it in front of people and see them enjoy it was actually probably the coolest part of this project.
The feedback on the tabletop version was so positive, they decided to launch a physical form of the game first. And that's what they're trying to do now. This summer, Rusty and Raymond launched their online Kickstarter campaign. They hope to fund the first making and distribution of War Command. And if the Kickstarter succeeds, those illustrators will make 20% of the profits. Rusty says if they don't get enough money to make the tabletop game this summer, they'll still release the mobile app early next year.
But if the Kickstarter succeeds, it'll be nice because we'll probably be able to preempt that a little bit and have the game board and stuff in stores around holiday season and then the app available right after.
But now, back to the game. It's bad enough waiting for a normal game to finish, but when the competition is between two brothers who are also the game designers, well, let me tell you, the stakes are high. Rusty's characters are cornered at the edge of the board. Raymond's commander is making an advance. He picks up the dice, rolls, and...
Ah!
Ooh. So 14 on a 9.
14 on a 9, I just won.
Better luck next time, Rusty. For AK, I'm Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell.
And now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the Alaska Peninsula community of King Cove.
My name is Della Trumbull. I am the part-time finance manager for King Cove Corporation and Agadel Tribal Council administrator, and I live in King Cove, Alaska. King Cove is surrounded by mountains. It's a fishing community, probably a population of about 1,000, close to 1,000. The community itself is dependent on the fishing industry. We have Peter Pan Seafood. Majority of households are fishermen. We have school, you know, high school, elementary school, Head Start, preschool.
So we do have people that work within the school district or the Aleutians Eastboro or the city of King Cove, the King Cove Corporation. So there are jobs in town other than the fishing industry. Well, in the summertime, if we can get the weather, which we haven't, we've had a lot of rain this summer, you know, we get out in the nice days and definitely get out hiking and watching bears, or, you know, as it gets later in the summer, we do our fishing, subsistence fishing, and berry picking. And it's always a busy time of the year, and it's a fun time of the year for us. The biggest issue that we are continuing to work on and have been for the last 35 years is the road between King Cove and Cold Bay. And right now we are working, we've been through the EIS with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and now we're working with the Secretary of Indian Affairs, Washburn, who is working with Secretary Jewell on basically trying to look at the human factor and the value of the lands and the land trade that both the King Cove Corporation and the state of Alaska have put forward. It is a beautiful community. The people here are very nice, and the sense of the community in this community has always been pretty awesome for a small community. You know, I think part of what King Cove is about, and I think that it's just a nice little community.
Della Trumbull is the finance manager for King Cove Corporation. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shady Grove Oliver, Alex Dwyer, Annie Fight, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Aaron Selvig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka and Shaylin Cochran in Soldotna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.